So, good evening, everyone. And this evening is the beginning of the five-week introductory course in mindfulness meditation. So, welcome, everyone, to this. And what will happen during these 5 weeks is I will somewhat systematically go through the basic instructions in mindfulness meditation. It's usually done systematically in our tradition, where we build on the instructions from week to week. And so for the first day today will be the kind of the foundation points about the meditation practice. And then next week we'll be talking about the body, how to include mindfulness of the body, and how mindfulness of the body is a very key element to Buddhist spiritual life. And then followed by a discussion about how to include our emotional life as part of the mindfulness practice, how to bring mindfulness and attention to that part of our life that we call our emotions. And then the fourth week, we'll be talking about how to bring mindfulness to our thinking, our thoughts. And then the fifth week will be a discussion about how to expand the practice of mindfulness into our daily life. And the idea being that I'm trying to convey that mindfulness is something we can bring to all aspects of our lives. It's not meant to be something limited just to meditation practice, but something that in all activities of our lives, but all our human experiences, can occur within the domain of awareness, of mindfulness, non-reactive awareness. So my name is Gil Fronsdal, and I have been a meditation teacher here in Palo Alto for about 11 years. And I have was trained for quite a while in the Japanese Zen tradition. And then I was introduced to Vipassana practice, or mindfulness meditation, in Southeast Asia, in Thailand and Burma, and where I practiced for some time. And then came back to this country and continued practicing here. And then about 1989, I was trained as a... began my training as a Vipassana teacher. Vipassana is... and I came to this community, to Palo Alto, because I started in 1990... as a graduate student at Stanford. And sometimes when I ask people to guess what I studied, most people say you probably studied psychology. But I studied Buddhism, Buddhist studies in the religious studies department. And I finished about 4 years ago with that, and now I'm settled in this community. And those of you who might have come for the first time this evening, you're just, in a sense, you're also being welcomed into our wide but very informal meditation community, mindfulness insight meditation community. We have meetings three times a week, and we have retreats that we do, and lots of different activities that we do as an extended kind of community. We run our community in a very relatively informal way. That's the goal. So those of you who are coming here, you're welcome to join, participate in any way you want. Come and go as you wish. And you're just quite welcome to participate as it seems useful to you. So let me ask you all, how many of you have had a background? How many of you are new to meditation? How many of you are new to this kind of meditation, Vipassana or insight meditation? So welcome to all of you. And the rest of you... why are you here? There's a story of Mullah Nasruddin going to a new... You know the story? Going to a new town, and he's going to give... He's a spiritual teacher, and he goes to a new town. And he says, he's highly anticipated, and there's a big crowd of people to come to hear him give some kind of sermon. And he gets up and says, do you understand? And they say no, because they're expecting to hear from him the truth. And he says, well, there's no point in telling you then. And so he leaves. And so then he goes to the next town. They heard about this, so he does the same thing there. And he says, do you understand? And they say yes, thinking then he would give a talk. And he says, well, then there's no need for me to give a talk, because you know. And he leaves. And so the third town he comes to, they heard what happened in the first two towns. So when he asks, do you understand? They reply, some of us do and some of us don't. And so he says, fine, those who understand can tell the ones who don't. Bye. These talks, this five-week introductory talk is taped. You see here it's been taped. And they've been taped in the past also. And some people like to get copies of them for a number of reasons. One reason is some people might miss a class and they'd like to hear what was talked about. And so Allison, who's sitting up there in the end, she makes those available, either from the past series or this series, if you ask her. And I'll be talking about meditation cushions and stuff, and pillows. And Allison also sells meditation paraphernalia. So if that's something that interests any of you, you can talk to Allison. And I think the last logistical thing to say before we kind of venture forth into the class is that in the Buddhist tradition that I teach in, there's a dedication to offering the teachings and the practice opportunities freely, as cheaply as possible, as freely given as possible. And that's how we're doing it here. And in return, what we do is we put donation baskets out in the hallway. And those of you who feel like you'd like to freely make a donation, you're welcome to do that. It's anonymous. Unless you do a check, then I guess we could see your name. But there's two baskets out there. One is for the rent. And we pay the friends for the use of the building. And if everyone donated a dollar or two, that would cover our rent just fine, and other expenses we might have, our newsletter and things. And then there's a donation basket for me, and that's for you to do as you wish, make a donation. And this is how I live, is I live because of the Buddhist tradition that I'm part of. I'm supported by people's donations. That's my source of livelihood. So there are two words in Pali, the ancient Buddhist language, that speak to the practice that I'll be teaching you. One is called sati. And sati means just, has been translated most commonly into English as mindfulness, the simple act of paying attention to what's going on. The second word is vipassana. And vipassana means something like clear seeing, to see clearly. And sometimes they're used synonymously. Sometimes vipassana is translated as insight, because vipassana is when you develop your mindfulness to be strong enough, you start seeing into the universal characteristics of our experience, of our life. So the idea is to develop the mindfulness enough to be able to penetrate the surface of what our experience is, to see something which is universal or something which is fundamental that underlies our life and our experience, which is not obvious on the surface as we live it. But mindfulness, or the sati by itself, doesn't require any depth of insight. Mindfulness is a capacity that we all have. All of us have the ability to pay attention. If you didn't have the ability to pay attention, you wouldn't be here trying to listen to me, if you didn't think you had some ability, because you're using attention to listen to my voice as I speak. Attention is something we all have, to be able to be aware of what's going on. And it can be likened to a muscle that can be strengthened. And as mindfulness becomes stronger, a lot of wonderful qualities enter into our lives in the wake of that strengthening mindfulness. One is we learn the skills of learning how to be present for things without being reactive to things. We learn how to be present maybe with a kind of extra little silence or stillness, so we don't automatically lash out or cling or run away or judge or get lost in our fear or lost in all the kind of crazy thoughts that we might have around something, what's going on. We have this ability to be present for things non-reactively. And this ability is considered in the Buddhist tradition to be a wonderful gift that we give to people around us and to ourselves. Because as long as we're reacting to the world around us, there's very little room for wisdom and kindness and receptivity to what's going on. And But if there is that stillness or that presence, that non-reactive awareness, then there's a possibility for kindness, compassion, for wisdom, for the wise part of us to respond to the world rather than our reactivity. So to learn how to be present for things without reacting is a phenomenal gift. And sometimes we'll be called upon to use that in times of crisis. And if you just simply learn the teachings, if you read a book or hear some teachings about mindfulness, and you kind of understand the basic principles, but you haven't actually built up the muscle, haven't built up your ability to use it, those skills, then you come to the situation of crisis, and you know theoretically what you can do, but you won't have the skills and the strength to really apply it. What happened last Tuesday is in September 11th was one of those times of crisis. I know a lot of people after that kind of event are looking for something deeper in their lives, finding a different way of responding to the world around them than maybe that they really had developed earlier in their life. One of the ways to develop is a spiritual life. One of the ways to respond to a situation like that, there's many ways we should respond, but one of the ways of responding is to find out how we can be the forces of peace in our own community. And if we're going to be forces of peace in our own community, we have to begin with ourselves and be able to somehow get a handle on the reactive mode in which the mind, the heart, responds to the world around us. The way in which we get caught by our fear, by our anger, our hate, our despair, our confusion. So mindfulness is a very, very important thing to develop because it helps us find the way to be present for things without reacting to it. When we don't react to things, then there's an added benefit of mindfulness, and that is we begin seeing more clearly what's actually happening. And that's one of the key functions of mindfulness, is to help us see clearly what's happening. See things as they are is the catch word, catch expression of Buddhism. Buddhism is teaching us to see things how they actually are, as opposed to how we imagine they might be. In order to be able to see things as they are, we have to be able to see through or step aside from our reactive mode of seeing, our bias, our prejudice that we have. So mindfulness is a very simple phenomenon. It's a simple ability to pay attention. There's nothing inherently Buddhist about it. It doesn't belong to any religious tradition. It doesn't belong to, you know, it's just a human quality we all have. You're not being asked to kind of become Asian or adopt Asian ways, or you're not being asked to adopt Buddhist teachings. What this class is about is how to strengthen and cultivate and reinforce, nourish, nurture this ability to pay attention in a non-reactive way to our life in the present moment. I wanted to say something more as an introduction that ties into what happened September 11th. In times of crisis like that, there's a very strong tendency for many people for the mind to have a kind of centrifugal force that takes us out of ourselves, where we're looking into the future, what might happen in the future now. We look across the country to what happened, and we're kind of maybe caught by our despair, our dismay, our fear. Or perhaps we're caught by our own emotions, but our own emotions trigger a whole series of kind of rapid associated thoughts and ideas and opinions, and we get lost in the world of our thoughts. And it's very easy to lose touch with oneself in times of crisis. And what Buddhism teaches is that if we're going to make a difference to the world around us, if we're going to try to meet it with compassion and care and peacefulness, we have to learn how to be centered, in a sense, on ourselves. We have to learn how to nourish ourselves, take care of ourselves. We have to learn how to be present for ourselves and know really what we're feeling, know what our motivations are, know what we're thinking, rather than those things kind of being an automatic pilot. And then we start reacting and acting in the world, and later we found out, you know, boy, why did I do that? What was that all about? And so One response that Buddhism has towards times of crisis like this is to encourage us to go back into ourselves and find some ability to be centered on ourselves. Not as an escape, by any means, absolutely not, but rather as a place where we can then be most useful to the world around us. So then once we've centered on ourselves, then hopefully we can go out and help the world. But if we're trying to help the world and we've forgotten about what's going on in here, then it's possible, it's all too easy to continue wreaking havoc on the world. So for the Buddhist tradition, at least, mindfulness is a very important quality to develop. And it's been said that it's really the core aspect. Some people call it the heart of Buddhist practice or meditation is the practice of mindfulness. So I'll certainly make references during these 5 weeks to Buddhism. But I don't want to offer this practice as a Buddhist practice so much. I want to really offer it as something that's universally useful for everyone. And if you hear the B word and don't like it, you can just tune that word out, or leave that part of the class here when you go home, or, you know, it's really optional from what I'm teaching during these 5 weeks. One thing that tends to happen during these instructions I give is that I slide back and forth between talking about mindfulness as something you do in meditation practice and mindfulness as something that you do in daily life. You go about your work and driving around or whatever you might do in daily life. And I want to say that up front so that you don't get confused because I really don't want to make an absolute distinction between meditation and daily life. And mindfulness is meant to be applied in all areas of our life, not just in meditation, even though I'll be talking a lot about how to do the meditation practice itself. So let's start with that, with meditation. So meditation practice, sitting in formal meditation, sitting meditation, requires a foundation. It's very helpful to have a foundation of setting yourself up, kind of a preparation for doing it. And one of the key aspects of preparation is to be very careful with the posture you take when you sit down. Many of us in our daily lives are quite familiar with sitting down for whatever reason and being kind of casual or unattentive to how we sit. When you sit down to meditate, you want to sit down in a way that's conscious. We actually take into account how your body feels, what posture feels alert and supportive of wakefulness and attentiveness, and the kind of posture that hopefully you can sustain in the course of the meditation. So if you're going to sit on the floor, which is the classic stereotypic way of meditating, usually people will say we sit cross-legged on the floor. There are some advantages to sitting on the floor. One of the advantages is simply that your center of gravity is lower and you have a tripod with your legs, and so it's very stable. And the stability of the tripod and the lower center of gravity makes it easier for most people, it's not necessarily automatic, but with time, to let their body relax. All the holding patterns, the shoulders and the stomach that we might be holding a lot, can begin relaxing when we take an aligned, upright sitting posture. It's not necessary to sit on the floor. It has pragmatic benefits, but some people can't, or some people have no interest. And you're welcome to sit in a chair, but when you sit in a chair, you want to be also careful with your posture and take a posture which seems conducive to being alert. If you sit in the chair like a couch potato, it's not really going to be supportive of the efforts to develop your mindfulness. If you're sitting on the floor, it's helpful to sit on a cushion or sit up a little bit. And these Japanese round cushions called zafus are quite nice to sit on. And the reason to sit up on a cushion is so that your pelvis can be tipped forward slightly. And because of the elevation, it's easier to get your knees to drop down to the floor. And if you can have your two knees on the floor, then you have this tripod, these three points of your knees and your butt, and the tripod is relatively stable. And some people need to sit higher, some people lower. If you're quite stiff in your hips, you want to sit higher. And some people maybe take a couple of these and stack them on top of each other to get more height. And if you're really loose in your hips, for example, you might want to sit really low. And this pillow here, for example, might be too high for you. And you want to experiment with that, the height, until you feel comfortable. When you sit on the floor, one very nice way of sitting is what's called Burmese style, which is one foot, both legs on the floor, one foot in front of the other, so that the legs are not actually crossed. And that puts the least amount of torque on your ankles and hip and your knee. And for most people, that's relatively comfortable and works fairly well. So like this, can you just kind of get the idea of what I'm saying? And you can also sit quarter lotus, which is you have one foot up on your calf. You can sit half lotus, which is one foot up on your thigh. And then you can sit full lotus, which is to have both feet up on your thigh. I can't quite do it today. And so all these ways are nice ways of sitting. And you can experiment and see which way you're doing. A good yoga teacher would say that you should alternate which leg is in front or on top, so you stretch your body equally on both sides. Part of the reason to take care of the base is so that you can have your spine upright for the length of time of the sitting. And if you have a little bit of a curve in your lower back, just a little bit, maybe slightly, just a little bit accentuate the lower curve, that's the natural curve, then you have a little bit of strength there that makes it a little bit easier for most people to keep their spine upright in the course of the sitting so you don't collapse. Some people overarch their lower back, and you want to be careful with that. Then maybe you want to sit lower on the cushion or relax your stomach muscles or something. One way to help you get a straight spine is to take your hands either side of your hips on the floor and lift yourself almost off the cushion. And then let your shoulders kind of roll back. And then let go of your arms and settle down. Straight down. Maybe your shoulders then will roll back a little bit and feel more like they're hanging. And that kind of gives you a sense maybe of a spine that's a little bit more alert and aligned than you would normally have it. If you're sitting in a chair, the usual suggested way of sitting is to have both legs parallel to each other, so they're not crossed, and straight out with both feet flat on the ground. Though some people like to have their legs spread out to a side, they feel more stable that way. But the usual suggestion is parallel, going straight out. And with your knees slightly lower than your hips. Certainly you don't want to have your knees higher than your hips, because if they're higher than your hips, then it tends to you tend to curve out your lower back and put a strain there. If you're on the chair and you can avoid using the backrest, that's the best, in the sense that there's a very strong correlation between what goes on in our inner life, our psychic life, and what goes on with our physical posture. And in that, Buddhist practice is helping us become more self-reliant. The development of self-reliance is a little bit easier if your body is self-reliant also. So if your back, for example, allows for it, to sit away from the backrest a little bit so you don't have to use it is considered very helpful. If you need to use a backrest, then the choice would be to, if you can, just support the lower back. Get a really good support for lower back and have your upper spine free from the backrest. It would be the best. But if you have to use the whole backrest, that's a fine thing to do also. The hands, you can do anything with the hands where they're basically doing the same thing, kind of symmetrical to each other. The classic way of meditating is to have the hands together, one in front of the other. Sometimes you have them on top of your heel or on top of your foot. Sometimes you have your hand up, kind of floating in front of your belly button. Or you can have your hands on your thighs, your knees. Hands up or hands down, doesn't matter. Sometimes when people have their hands on their ankle or on their heel or sometimes on their knee, they're pulling their shoulders forward, and they tend to create a strain in the neck or in the back of the shoulders. And so if you start feeling a strain like that, you want to get some way to lift up your hands a little higher up. And one way to do that is to get a towel or a blanket or a pillow and put them under your hands so your hands are a little bit higher, support a little bit higher. The head should be aligned on the shoulders, which sounds obvious, but sometimes people will stick their head forward. Sometimes they're leaning to the side, or sometimes turning to the side a little bit like that. And you want to be careful, and it helps sometimes to pull the head back a little bit and the chin down. And the wonderful thing that does, it tends to make a little bit of open space between the last vertebrae and the skull. And if you try to make that openness there, it tends to bring the chin down a little bit. And it's said that if your chin tucks down a little bit when you meditate, it tends to control the wandering mind. You won't think, you won't get lost in your thoughts so easily. Though you might not believe it if you do it. We sit in our tradition generally with the eyes closed, and that's what we recommend. Though there are Vipassana teachers who teach people to sit with their eyes open, there's no inherent need to sit with the eyes closed. But pragmatically, it seems to be most useful for most people. They're less distracted in what goes on around them. And it's helpful to have the eyes, the mouth closed, with the tongue resting against the roof of the mouth. So that's the basic points of the posture. If you're sitting on the floor and you can't sit cross-legged, or you want to take a break from sitting cross-legged, some people sit on benches like this and stick their legs underneath. So you're kind of more like you're sitting on your knees. And some people, if you have a round cushion, will put it upright like this and then put the cushion down between your ankles and then sit down on it like that. And for some people, that works very well. And you get your center of gravity really low. And it can be comfortable. So you've been sitting for a little while now. What I'd like to ask you to do, or suggest you, offer you to do, is you stand up for 30 seconds or so quietly, just to stretch, and then we'll do a little meditation. So then take an alert but comfortable posture. And then give yourself a few moments to kind of move around a little bit in your chair or in your seat, kind of to find the place where the body feels comfortable but alert. Where it feels kind of a little bit energized, perhaps. Gently close your eyes. And then to begin a sitting, it can be useful to take two or three deep breaths, long deep breaths, from the deep inside your body, expanding your torso, your rib cage as you breathe in. And then as you exhale, to let go. To let go of the tensions of the day, let go of your thoughts, your concerns. Breathing in deeply to be reminded to be present here and now. To your immediate experience. Exhaling, letting go. And then let your breath return to normal. There's no right or wrong way to breathe when you do mindfulness meditation. You just breathe whatever way you happen to be breathing. You don't have to be making your breath be any kind of way. And it can be also helpful at the beginning of a meditation session to scan through your body to see if there's any obvious places where the muscles are tense that you can let go of. You might start with your forehead. As you exhale, relax the forehead, the eyebrows. Some people carry a lot of tension in their eyes. You might begin by having some softness in the eyes, not expecting the tension to go away, but just a little bit of softening in that part of your body. Perhaps the jaws. Perhaps you can soften the shoulders, shoulder blades. And it can be particularly useful to soften the belly. To relax the muscles there. Let the belly kind of hang forward in a way that might seem very unbecoming. Let it relax. If you have a belt that's tight, you might loosen it. And after having done these kind of preliminary exercises for starting the meditation, then you want to begin the actual meditation by becoming aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences the breathing. If you have trouble feeling your breath, your breathing, then you might just for a little while breathe a little bit more fully than usual until you can feel the sensations of breathing, breathing in and out. Or you can put your hands on your belly and feel the movement of your belly as you breathe. And the simplest idea of breath meditation is for you to become aware of your breathing, of your body's experience of breathing in and breathing out, and then to sustain the attention over time on your breath. Inevitably, your mind will wander off into thoughts. There's no need to make that a problem, or to think that it shouldn't happen. However, the practice is, when you first notice, the first time you notice that's what's going on, then very matter-of-factly, very gently, begin again, attending to your breathing. Part of what we're doing in meditation is developing the ability for our mind and body to be the same place at the same time. If you're sitting here and you're thinking about what happened during the day today or what's going to happen tomorrow, then your body is in one place and in a sense your mind, your thoughts are directed to some other place, other time. By directing our attention to something as simple as the breathing, the breath can be an anchor, keeping the body and mind in the same place at the same time. Since it's not always so easy to stay with the breathing, there's a very simple aid you can use. And that is, each time you breathe in, you very silently, very quietly whisper in the mind. Think the word in, or rising, as you're aware of the rising of your belly and chest. And each time you exhale, there's a very quiet note in the mind, gentle note that says, out, or falling, as you're aware of the chest or the abdomen falling as you exhale. It's a way of using a thought, thinking, to help you stay present for what's going on, rather than your thoughts just randomly pulling you away. Letting go of your thoughts and concerns, and beginning again with the breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. Hanging in there for the rhythm of your breathing. Hanging in there for each successive breath. We'll sit for one more minute, and during this last minute, give yourself over to the breathing, letting the rhythm of the breath perhaps calm your mind and body. Hang in there for 1 minute. There's a story of a Zen master and a some wealthy bureaucrat, I think, came to visit him, who was going to ask the Zen master for a piece of calligraphy. It was one of the things Japanese Zen masters often did, that they did calligraphy as gifts to people. And the man came to the Zen master and said, "Can you, kind of in a nutshell, in calligraphy on this piece of paper, write the essence of Buddhism?" And so the Zen master said, "Oh yeah, I can do that." So he wrote on this piece of paper the word in Japanese, attention. And he handed the paper to the man. And the man said, "You didn't seem to understand. I wanted the essence of Buddhism." And so the Zen master said, okay. And so he, or she, wrote, attention, attention. And the man said, "You didn't seem to understand. I mean, Buddhism is this great, lofty philosophy and religion. It's believed by millions of people, and it's traveled from India to China to Japan. It's sustained this huge culture, and, you know, it's the pinnacle of human thought," or whatever, you know. "And, you know, I really want the essence of it, you know, the real, you know, what's the really core aspect?" "Oh," said the Zen master, "now I get it, what you want. Now I understand." So then he wrote on a piece of paper, "Attention, attention, attention." The point of mindfulness is to develop our capacity to pay attention. When we do breath meditation, some people will measure the success of their breath meditation by how well they can stay with the breath. If I can follow 10 breaths in a row, that's really good. Or if I can follow the breath the whole meditation time, then I'm really doing it right. But if I can only follow 3 breaths at a time and then I lose it in my thoughts, then I'm just a failure at this and I might as well take up, you know, contra dancing or something else. It's certainly a wonderful thing and very profound to develop our concentration on the breathing, to be able to stay with the breath. As we get more concentrated on the breath, and as we hang in there with the breath and strengthen our ability to stay with the breath over time, it makes it a lot easier for a lot of the ways in which the mind holds on to thoughts, ideas, all kinds of things, fall away. And the mind tends to become calmer. The body tends to become calmer the longer we stay with the breath in a kind of natural way. The breath is one of the great calming influences on the psyche. So it's quite wonderful to stay with the breath over time. But you don't want to measure the success of mindfulness by your ability to stay with the breath. What mindfulness is the practice of learning to pay attention to what is actually happening. And if what is actually happening is you can't be with the breath for very long, the practice of mindfulness is simply to be aware, I'm not with the breath very much. My mind is kind of out of control. And to do that, to be aware of that phenomena in a non-reactive way. What we're developing is not just simply awareness, but non-reactive awareness to what's going on. And for a lot of people, this is a radical thing to do, because a lot of people's awareness is tinged by aversion, by confusion, by fear, by judging all the time. And to have non-reactive awareness is a very, very compassionate thing to do for ourselves. So if you can't stay with the breath, then the practice is simply to notice my mind is rushing off at 10,000 miles an hour. I'm completely consumed by worry about what's going to happen tomorrow. And simply notice those things with a non-reactive mind. One of the functions of breath meditation is to help us become more aware of what's actually going on in the currents of our lives. If you go to a very still, kind of almost still flowing river, like a little creek, stream, sometimes you can look at it and it's very clear and maybe very shallow. And it can be very difficult to see whether the water is actually moving. But if you take a stick and stick it into the water, then you can see there's a little wake that's formed on the edge of the little stick. And you say, oh, indeed, the water is moving, the river is moving. We use the breath as a kind of same kind of reference point for the current of our life is we use a stick in that little stream. That as you become aware of your breathing, as you try to be aware of your breathing, what you might become mostly aware of is how difficult it is, how little of the time you're with your breath. And what you'll notice then is my mind is chaotic. It's out of control. It's wild. Or I'm really filled with emotions. I'm just kind of swirling about in all these feelings that are going on around and around and around. I keep getting caught by them or pulled into them. You start noticing what's actually going on. And if you didn't have that reference of the breath, you might not notice the speed in which your life is flowing, your mind and your heart and all this. Many of us will go about our life preoccupied with our concerns and won't actually notice how preoccupied we are. We're distracted by our distractions by our distractions. We're distracted from our distractions by our distractions. And we need some kind of way of stopping that, or some kind of way of having a reference to notice that, to step outside of it. So not all of us, all of our being is consumed by our preoccupation. And part of what we're doing in mindfulness is learning how to step outside of the stream of our normal preoccupations, the stream of our karmic, or our karma, as it says sometimes in Buddhism. And so if you can't stay with the breath, it's still very important to keep trying. To try to do your best to be with the breathing. But you don't have to measure your success by how well you're doing with the breath. It's fine to be an utter failure with the breath meditation. All you can do is manage one breath, and then you lose it. That's okay. As long as you're trying to stay with the breath, it's okay not to succeed. Isn't that wonderful? But in trying to do that, that's hopefully helping you become aware of what's actually going on for you. The thoughts, the feelings, the momentum of your mind, what's actually going on. And what mindfulness is simply noticing what's actually going on. And then trying to be notice it in a non-reactive way. Not to make a story out of it, or judge it, and something like that. So I like to say that mindfulness works even when it doesn't work. At least the breath meditation works even when it doesn't work. You don't have to be successful at concentrating on the breath to get the benefits of the practice. A lot of people don't know this little secret, and so they just make their life worse because they find it hard to stay with the breathing. And then they notice that, and they're reactive about that. Oh, I'm a failure, I can't do this, all kinds of thoughts that might arise. And then to come back again to your breathing, to notice all that, and then to come back again to your breathing, whenever you have a chance to come back to your breathing, that tends to counteract the forces of preoccupation, the forces of gravity that pull us into our preoccupations. Mind wants to go off in some kind of concern. There's a strong pull into those concerns, strong interest in those kinds of concerns. In order to come back to the breathing, even if it's just for one breath, you have to let go a little bit. And that little bit of letting go makes a big difference over time. With enough drops, the bathtub is filled. With enough little moments of letting go of your preoccupation and coming back to the breath, you can learn to let go of the things that consume you and cause stress and tension in our life and begin discovering how breath meditation is very calming. It can bring a lot of peace in their lives. If we understand the principle is not to be reactive when we notice, just to notice where we're at, and then to learn to let go of it enough to come back to the breathing. Just come back to the breathing. And then stay with the breathing as best you can. And the breathing is kind of like a tonic. It tonifies the system. Just staying with the breath, letting it kind of be like an internal massage. The arising and passing, the lifting and falling of the chest and the torso as you breathe is very settling for the body. Can be. So I've talked for quite a while now. Before I go on, do you have any questions about what the meditation was like or in the meditation or from what I've said so far? Yes?
I have two questions. One is, I've gotten in the habit of counting the entire time, all my breaths. So like, I'll count up to even 300, and it's like almost like I can't meditate unless I'm counting my breaths continuously. And also, I wanted you to comment on what level of discomfort in your legs you should be with before you move.
Well, next week we'll talk about body sensations. So there'll be whole instructions about that include that. But as for discomfort in your leg, some people have the illusion that there is an ideal meditation posture, that if you can just find it, you'll sit in absolute comfort and physical comfort, and you know it'll just be great. There is no such posture. So part of meditation is also learning how to be wisely present for the discomfort that arises as you sit over some time in the same posture without moving. It's helpful not to move automatically, which is the way many people are. In normal life, we feel a little bit uncomfortable, we shift our posture. It's easier to develop a stillness and a clear focus of the mind if the body is still. And the more often we move, the more we disrupt, kind of create waves in the mind. But there's a trade-off, because at some point, if the discomfort becomes strong enough, it becomes agitating, and it creates its own waves in the mind. And also you can get discouraged and all that. So you have to kind of watch that carefully. And if you feel at some point that it's more agitating than useful to sit still, and it's beginning to discourage you because it's, you know, painful, by all means, change your posture. And you can change your posture in the spirit of mindfulness, where rather than kind of changing yourself automatically, kind of unconsciously, you change your posture very slowly. Kind of slowly change your posture to be aware of what's going on. Stay in the flow of mindfulness. As for counting the breath, it's a pretty classic Buddhist meditation practice to count the breath. It's a way of helping develop concentration and focus, staying with the breath. In order to keep count, you have to kind of be a little bit more alert, a little more tracking, a little bit more fully. So it's a very powerful aid. It tends to be a support for concentration practice more than mindfulness practice. So mindfulness teachers usually don't give instructions for counting unless there's some good reason for it. The usual instruction is to count from 1 to 10 and then start over again. And I think part of the reason is to keep it simple. And most people can keep track of 1 to 10. But if you get up to the hundreds and 200s, it's a little bit harder for most people to keep track of it. And you have to use, maybe, I think, I'm theorizing now, but I think you have to use a different part of your cognitive functioning to keep track of the higher numbers and kind of keep track of that and keep it going. And so the mind has to be a little more agitated in order to stay present for that. I never heard anyone recommend counting that far, just 1 to 10. And if you lose count from between 1 and 10, then just go back to 1 automatically. Don't think about it. And if you get up to 15, that's a sign that you, unless you're intending to, if you get up, you're intending to go to 10 and you go to 15, that's also a sign that you've lost your mindfulness. And just go back to 1. But in your situation, it might be interesting for you to look at why you find counting to 300 so useful, maintaining the count for so long. Okay, maybe later you want to tell me.
Stop.
Oh, when you get to 300, you can stop. Oh, you're keeping time. Oh, keeping time. So that brings up a practical issue. When you sit to meditate, how do you keep time? Especially in our tradition, where you keep the eyes closed. And for people who are beginning this series, never meditated before, I'd encourage you during this first week. It's very helpful for this 5-week series. If you start a daily meditation practice, sit every day, and you'll get the most out of these 5 weeks if you sit every day, and then kind of try to apply the instructions during the week, and then come the next week ready to kind of build on what you've done during the week. If you've never meditated before, start with 15 minutes a day this first week. And then each day, each week of these 5 weeks, add 5 minutes. So next Thursday you begin, you do 20 minutes, and next following Thursday you have 25 minutes. So build on that. And then after the 5 weeks, you can kind of decide for yourself how long you want to sit. But how do you know when your time is up? There's a lot of different solutions people have come up with. The cleverest, I think, is to tape record 15 minutes of silence on your cassette tape. And then and at the end of those 15 minutes, you ring a bell. You record the sound of a bell ringing. And then when it's time to meditate, you stick your meditation tape in your tape deck and turn it on, and it goes along silently for 15 minutes, and then you hear a bell, ding, ding. Some people like to do that way. I think there's a lot of timers on the market that are silent timers. And so you set it for 15 minutes, and it goes off, ding, after 15 minutes. And one classic way is to, in Buddhism, before they had clocks, is they would have incense sticks, and they would measure how long it took for a certain length of the incense stick to burn. So they had 15-minute sticks. And so they'd light it, stick it in the incense burner, and close their eyes, and they no longer smelt the smoke coming. And then they knew that the 15 minutes was up. So you might find it more relaxing to find an external aid. Other questions? Yes?
I have trouble going to sleep. I nod off.
Oh, you have trouble during meditation, falling asleep. Oh. Yeah, that's pretty common. There's a lot to be said about that, because there's a lot of different reasons why people fall asleep in meditation. We are a culture of people who are sleep deprived. And some people need to get to sleep more than they need to meditate. And so if that's your case, maybe just, you know, try to reorganize your life to get more sleep, if you can. Sometimes it's because we're meditating end of a day and we're kind of tired anyway. And if you meditate at the beginning of the day, which is a classic time to do your daily meditation practice, people tend to be more fresh and alert, and it's a lot easier. Some people fall asleep when they first start, because the only other time we fall asleep, we close our eyes, is when we go to sleep at night. And so there's a habit. And so you just have to kind of work with that habit for a while, and after a week or two, probably the habit will be broken. Some people fall asleep because they get too calm in meditation. A lot of people want calm. That's why they're coming to meditate, after all, is they want to get calm. The point of mindfulness is not to get calm. The point of mindfulness is to see clearly what's going on. But it's also possible to get too calm. And if you're too calm and don't balance that with a certain amount of alertness, people fall asleep. And there's a lot more I could say, but one more example. Some people fall asleep in meditation for the same reason that babies fall asleep when they're overstimulated. If you may have seen a baby go into too much noise, a lot of cacophony of noise or something, or too much light, they'll fall asleep as a protective mechanism. For adults, that protective mechanism seems to come into place around very powerful emotions or memories that are bubbling up that we don't want to look at. And so the system has some way of falling asleep so we don't have to look at what's really going on in our lives. From the point of view of mindfulness practice, we're trying to cultivate non-reactive awareness, which means it's okay to be sleepy. It's even okay to fall asleep. Your job is to try the best you can to be mindful of what's actually happening. If you're falling asleep, we'll talk more about this. This will make more sense next week. But if you're getting very sleepy or tired, then what the mindfulness practice entails is bringing your careful attention to the sensations in your body of sleepiness. So you take sleepiness as the object of your meditation. So you feel the heaviness in your eyes, the grit in your eyes, the heaviness and the kind of flushness and the heat perhaps in your cheeks and the weight in your shoulders and the fogginess in your mind and stickiness in different places. And you begin exploring it, investigating and waking up, really seeing that for what it clearly is in and of itself. And sometimes that's enough to wake a person up, just that investigation. And there's also the pragmatic thing of opening your eyes when you meditate. Some people find if you open your eyes when you sit and meditate, look at a light source or out a window, that with the eyes open, that then it overcomes the tendency to fall asleep. Yes, please.
I think my question might be sort of related to hers, but sometimes in that space in between thoughts, if you're able to stop, as a beginner, if I'm able to sort of focus in that space, sometimes it seems scary. I mean, I'm not used to that space, and so it's almost, I mean, I just wonder lots of things about it, like, what is it? Is that my subconsciousness, or, I mean, it frightens me.
The space between your thoughts.
Yeah, because I think it's just like I'm going into a trance, but sometimes it feels like it. It feels like this, I could just go off into this place and maybe never come back, I don't know.
Meditation practice, or spiritual life in general at times, is kind of like being thrown into a lake without knowing how to swim. And because you don't know how to swim, at first the person trashes about and is really afraid. And what we learn to do after a while is that all we have to do is relax and the water holds us up. The analogy isn't perfect, but the idea being that what happens is we let go of our thoughts, let go of the reference of our thoughts, can be very frightening for people, terrifying for some people who think they only exist if they're thinking. If their whole way of having a self-identity is mediated through ideas and thoughts, what they think, what they feel, it can be very frightening not to have a self-identity that's mediated by your thoughts and ideas. And part of the spiritual practice is to learn to have trust that it's okay not to hold on to self-identity, not to hold on to thoughts, and allow something else to happen. So probably for you, it's a matter of developing more trust, that it's okay to go in that space between your thoughts. It's okay to let go of your thoughts and discover a whole other aspect of your life. Your thinking, actually, it's kind of like a tip of an iceberg. And most people, you know, it's kind of like, say you spent your whole life watching television. And you're really happy because that's all you know. And you're also really happy because you have a lot of channels. And you have cable, you know. And you know, it's like 100 channels, you know, and you get to surf and just all these old movies. And it's just endless entertainment. It's such variety. And if you get bored with one, you turn the other on. And it's just really great. And you know, this is really, there's a lot of depth to it and there's a lot of variety. And this is like, this is what more could you want? And then one day there's a blackout. And the television doesn't work. And for the first time in your life, you leave your house and you're walking down the street and you look at the trees and your birds and things are three-dimensional and you smell the flowers and the neighbors are smiling at you and the sun is shining and the rain falls on your cheeks and then you go by this wonderful, you know, ice cream store and they have, you know, and you actually taste the flavors for years, just the commercials, you know. The commercials are quite they're very interesting, you know. But now you actually taste, you know, and you realize you've been living in a two-dimensional world, and suddenly you stepped into a three-dimensional world. So our thoughts are so compelling. We paint the whole world, and we live in the filter. We see the world through our thoughts, much more than we realize. And it's so seductive, so alluring. We think that's all there is. We don't. It's like a fish who's not supposed to see the water because it's the element it lives in. We don't see the air because we, you know, but we don't see the thoughts that we live in because they're so familiar. But they're really just the tip of the iceberg, and we're living in a two-dimensional world. If we're only living in the world of thoughts, and to learn to let go of them a little bit and discover what's underneath the water of the iceberg, you discover phenomenal depth of life, a depth of compassion, of peace, of love, of fear, of terror. You know, what's underneath that surface of the iceberg is really a lot. It's very varied, and it's your whole humanity, and it's really well worth your while to open up to it. It can be very frightening. So what you want to do is do it in small steps. There's no hurry. No one's rushing you along. And just take your time. And if you need help from other people who've been there before, reach out to other people and they'll help you. And then if you stay confused about what's going on, it's really good to be... If it's really foreign what's happening to you, it's really good to talk to other people who've been there before so they can give you some guidance or some reassurance that it's okay. Does that address your concern? Which is like a drug? The thoughts or
the thoughts.
What?
In between the thoughts.
It can be like a drug. And thoughts are also like a drug. And And what we're trying to do in Buddhist meditation is no longer be intoxicated. It's possible to be intoxicated by our thoughts. It's also possible to be intoxicated by what happens in meditation. So some of the things you're concerned about might be actually very valid to be concerned about, the certain intoxication, a certain kind of seduction of the states that can arise out of that. And some of these deeper states of meditation, it's very important to be around a teacher who can help a student not to get intoxicated by the states of meditation. What's very interesting about the mindfulness practice, vipassana, which is very difficult for people to understand, so I'll tell you a challenging thing, is that mindfulness meditation is not concerned about having any kind of particular experience. We are often looking for an experience of calm, of peace, of great enlightenment, or some kind of experience which is going to tell us, now I've done it right, I've succeeded spiritually, or there's many reasons why we want an experience. Am I doing it right? Is this the right experience I'm having right now? They come to me and ask. Mindfulness practice is not about an experience. It's about how we see our experience, how we relate to our experience. So it doesn't really matter what your experience is. It could be the most horrendous experience and the most blissful experience. What's important is how we hold it, how do we bring this non-reactive awareness to that experience. Does that make sense? So what we're doing in mindfulness, it's kind of like Buddhism sometimes distinguishes between two aspects of awareness. There is what awareness is aware of, the content of awareness. Your awareness is now listening to me speak, and you're focusing supposedly on my words, my sentences. So my sentences are the content of your awareness. If you're looking at something, the sight object is the content of your awareness. If you're thinking about something, your thoughts are the content of your awareness. If you're thinking and aware of that you're thinking. So most of us are orienting ourselves by the objects of awareness. We come into a room we've never been before, and we're kind of maybe a little bit wary of who are these people. And so we're kind of hyper-alert a little bit in who to sit with and what's going on here and how do I find myself. And we're focusing outward and what's going on in the room, the objects of the room. Or maybe we're very much obsessed about our self-identity, what people think about us. And so we're focusing always in on what am I saying? Am I doing the right thing? And so what's the object of attention then is our self-preoccupation. So it's kind of completely normal to have an object of awareness. But there's something else, and that is awareness itself. There's object of awareness, and there's awareness. And most people are always focusing on the object of awareness, and therefore they're very interested in having a particular kind of experience that's the right experience, a better experience. As mindfulness develops, as its muscle gets stronger and stronger, what happens is that the awareness by itself stands more and more independent of what it's aware of. And as awareness becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and more independent of what it's aware of, then we take refuge, we can rest in the security of the peace of awareness itself. So there might be times in your life where you've had an experience of great still awareness where a lot of stuff can come into your awareness. You can be aware, see things and hear things and think things. But somehow it doesn't ruffle this great big peacefulness of awareness which it seems so large. Awareness can become independent of what it's aware of. And when awareness becomes independent of what it's aware of, then you're not defining your life and your happiness by the objects of what happens in life, by the experience you have, by the things that happen around you, the people you're related to, by the amount of money in your bank account or the kind of house you live in. All those things become secondary to the phenomenal love and peace and joy, in a sense, that is inherent in awareness by itself. Does that make sense, or is that too mystical? So what we're doing in mindfulness practice is not looking for a better experience. but rather looking to how to develop the mindfulness of what actually is happening right now. So this is also challenging for people because, say you sit down to meditate and you're feeling tense, tired, headachy, the normal thing to want to do is to try to sit in such a way to like get rid of all that. If I just sit quietly here, my tension will go away, I'll feel calm, my headache will go away, and then we focus, we try to kind of negotiate our meditation to make those things happen. And sometimes we can be successful, and that's great because that kind of reinforces the fact that I'm in control, I can do it, you know. It's actually much more radical and transformative to not use the meditation as a way to change yourself, but rather use the meditation as a place to develop this independent awareness, which is larger, independent of what your experience is. So rather than being happy because your headache has gone away, you become happy because you realize that you're much bigger than the headache. So we're constantly trying to develop the mindfulness. We're not necessarily trying to change our experience when we're sitting. In the long term, you're much better off by developing this capacity for independent awareness, because that you can bring with you everywhere. If what you've developed is skills for how to get rid of your tension, it's a good skill to have. I wouldn't knock it. It's very useful in life to get rid of your tension. But if you're relying on that all the time, there are situations you'll come to where you won't be able to use your skills and you'll stay tense. But if you learn how to take refuge or find this independent awareness that can be present for things without being caught by things, then you can go into the world in a much more useful way. So to begin this first week, the focus is on establishing a good meditation posture and beginning to become familiar with your breathing. And I use the word familiar very carefully. Explore your breath, your breathing. Get to know it. Study it. Find out what it's like in different circumstances. Our breath expresses, to a great extent, what's going on in our life. If we're tense, the breath will express that tension. If we're afraid, the breath will express the fear. For anger, the breath will express the fear in a different way. Different ways in which we hold the breath and tighten different ways, or loose or relaxed, or the breath is fast or shallow. None of it needs to be changed. None of it is wrong from the point of view of mindfulness. But it's very useful to begin studying it and becoming familiar. When you're driving in your car and you come to a stoplight, if you have a few seconds there, study your breathing. And see how your way you drive affects how you breathe. If you're standing in line at a store, just check in with your breathing. Discover something there. When you're having a conversation with someone, check in periodically with your breathing. And see if the breath can be a cue, can tell you more information about how you're reacting, how you're living your life, and what the cost is of living a certain way, the tense way you're living, for example. Become familiar with your breathing. In meditation, study your breath, get to know it. Learn how to hang in there with it. Learn how to rest with the rhythms of the breath. It's kind of like the waves coming in and out of from the ocean. You're kind of riding the waves. You ride the in-breath and the out-breath, the in-breath, the out-breath. Hang in there. Discover what happens when you stay with the breath. Discover what happens, what's going on inside of you when you can't be with the breath. It's a whole process of exploration, of investigation, of curiosity, of getting to know these things. Sit, if you're new to all this, sit 15 minutes a day. If most people find it best to sit in the morning before life begins kind of very actively. Some people find it's best to sit in the evening. It varies from different people. It's up to you. It's best if you sit in such a time and a place where you're not going to be disturbed by the phone. It's really important, if you give yourself 15 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes, that this is how long you're going to sit, that you give yourself a commitment to see the sitting to the end. You're welcome to change your posture if it gets physically uncomfortable. But there's a wonderful phenomenon that happens in meditation. You're sitting there meditating quite peacefully. You're quite happy. Maybe even you feel like you're on the brink of full enlightenment. And then suddenly this thought occurs to you that the freezer needs to be defrosted. And it needs to be defrosted right now. And so you want to be very careful with those kinds of, you know, there's all these funny ways that the mind wants to distract you from being present. And so to have a commitment to sit the time out, not let a telephone call, telephone get you out, pull you out, not let anything within reason pull you out of your period of meditation. It's also helpful to find a place in your home, if you have such a place, like a corner of a bedroom, that's your meditation place, where the only thing that happens in that place is meditation, so that you associate that place with sitting, with being present. If it has other associations, then it's not as conducive to supporting the practice. One or two more questions that seem important? Please.
When I start focusing on the breath, I get anxious around it. And it doesn't feel good.
Are you relatively new to meditation?
Pretty new, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's two things you can do. One is remind yourself that it's okay to be anxious around the breath. It's okay to be the way you are. Mindfulness practice is simply notice more carefully, maybe compassionately, in a very friendly way, I'm being anxious. And the more I'm with the breath, the more anxious I seem to get. And wow, the meditation teacher says that's okay, as long as I'm present for it. And if you do that, what you might find after a while is you begin to relax again. It no longer becomes a problem. If you just hang in there long enough and kind of see it through for a while. If it builds to a state of being a panic attack or something, then probably it's not so useful for you to go that far. And what you might want to do then is ignore the breath for a while in your meditation practice. And there's the alternative anchor practice for mindfulness is sounds. And sounds, for people who get really anxious around the breath, sounds are much more neutral. And so what that entails is we stay present for whatever sounds are happening around us. And just stay kind of riding the sounds, listening to the sounds, listening, hearing. And whenever the mind wanders off into thought, come back to the sounds. Come back to the sounds. And that's one way to help us get into the present moment more fully. And then after a while, you might find it then easier to come back to your breath once you've established some level of calm and presence. Yes?
Yeah, what about playing music?
I love this story of these two monks who go to the abbot, and the first one says, "Is it okay to smoke while I'm praying?" And the abbot says, "No way. When you pray, you should just pray." And the second monk goes to the abbot and says, "Is it okay to pray while I smoke?" And the abbot says, "Oh, of course, you should pray at every activity you do." I think that, generally, though, it's not so useful. Some people find that it's very relaxing to listen to music. There's even meditation music you can get that kind of helps you get calm. If what you want to do is to de-stress and get calm, then music is great. It can be great for people, if that's your intention. If your intention is to develop your mindfulness, your presence, to see things directly as they are, then you're better off not listening to music and just leaving yourself alone and just being present for who you actually are, not who you would rather be. Does that make sense? So, thank you. And I hope that next week that I don't talk as much, because usually I like to do at least two short sittings during the course of our hour and a half together and talk a little bit about that. And if you have any further questions at any point at the end now, please come up and ask me. I see it as my job to try to be as helpful as I can as you're trying to figure out how to do this practice. It's really a marvelous practice, the mindfulness practice. For me, it's one of the most lovely things in the world to do. And I really love sharing it with you. So I'm happy that you're here, and hopefully you'll find some benefit from all this. Thank you.